listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Margaret Wertheim's new book, Physics on the Fringe, looks at outsider physicists whose theories are a store, she tells us, of imaginative thinking about how our universe might be constructed. Her book challenges our conception of what science is, how it works, and who it's for. A large portion of this passionate and beautifully written book is an insightful portrait of outsider physicist Jim Carter, known as the Cyclone Science Man. Margaret was captivated by the imaginative power of his theories and his resolutely do-it-yourself attitude. She's been following Jim Carter's progress for the past decade. And for the past 50 years, I think it was 50 years by the time this book was published, Jim Carter, who now owns a trailer park in Enumclaw, Washington, has been developing his own alternative theory of everything. His radically new synchronicity theory, and synchronicity is a word I very much like, offers us a complete description of the universe that substitutes for relativity, quantum mechanics, and the Big Bang. When he is not doing physics, Jim has spent much of his life working as a gold miner and abalone diver. He fixes his own cars and has built his own house, complete with a secret cave. He's also gone hunting for a giant meteorite. He does not have a PhD and never graduated from college, and he is the author of two books, one of which, I think actually there are two of them, one of them is The Other Theory of Physics, and they are for sale tonight, along with Margaret's book. Margaret Wertheim is an internationally acclaimed science writer and curator whose work focuses on the relations between science and the wider cultural landscape. She's a native Australian, she has degrees in physics and mathematics, and she's the author of Pythagoras' Trousers, A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion, The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet, and of course the book we'll focus on tonight, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. She's a longtime journalist, has written for great publications, The Guardian, The New Scientist, The New York Times, and from 2000 to 2005, she wrote the Quark Soup Science column for the LA Weekly. In 2003, Margaret and her twin sister Christine founded the Institute for Figuring, an innovative Los Angeles-based organization dedicated to the aesthetic and poetic dimensions of science and mathematics. And I think some of you here might have seen the IFF's Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef. How many of you might have seen that? Fantastic exhibition. It's the biggest participatory art science project in the world. You can look at it on Margaret's website and see her TED talk about it. And it's inspired communities throughout the USA, the UK, Australia, South Africa, Germany, all around the world. And the first exhibition at the new Los Angeles Gallery of the Institute for Figuring, opening on December 17th, will present the work of Jim Carter and other outsider scientists through diagrams, models, and animations. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back to Aloud and the Los Angeles Public Library, Margaret Wertheim. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. It's a real joy to be back here. I love this place. Tonight I'm going to be talking about my new book, Physics on the Fringe. And what this book is about is people who are operating outside, completely outside the mainstream scientific culture, who are in their own backyards and homes, are working away on their own theories of the universe. It's what I've come to call outsider science, which is a kind of parallel to a subject that I'm sure a lot of you here already know quite a bit about, outsider art. And the book is really the first attempt that I know of to really try to understand what the phenomenon of outsider science means in relationship to our cultures, at relation to science itself. So I'm looking at people like Jim Carter, who are completely outside the mainstream, but because I actually want to use this to reflect on what the whole of science, including the mainstream, really means to us as a society and a culture. So I've been collecting the... is it possible that we could have... the? Can you see the screen? Great. Okay. Terrific. I've been collecting the works of outsider scientists for about 18 years now, and it turns out there's a surprising number of these people. I've got on my shelves more than 100 such theories. A lot of them are single articles, but a surprising number of them are full-length books, and every one of these books there is somebody's own theory of physics. Now, these people come from all walks of life. You'd be surprised. Quite a few of them are engineers, but many of them have no training in science or technology, you know, at a formal academic level. And I've met people who are doing this from all walks of life, people who are used car salesmen, people who are artists, people who are mathematicians. There's actually a famous Hollywood film editor who has a theory of his own. I've met a retired California Supreme Court judge who has a theory of his own. And one of the things I've come to understand over almost 18 years of collecting these people is that any generalizations you care to name about this kind of thing, any kind of presupposition you might have in your mind, is likely to be wrong. The only sort of, as it were, unifying theme I have been able to find about these people is that most of them are men. There are very few women. There are a few, but there are very few women who are dreaming up alternative theories of space and time, except for the fact that, of course, women in some ways have been dreaming up alternative theories of reality since the dawn of time. But I want to specifically focus today on Jim Carter, who is, I think, in a unique class. In all of my encounters with outsider physicists, I've never met another one like Jim. Jim, I think, is in some ways the Leonardo of outsider science. So Jim will be joining us in a few minutes. But here is Jim actually at the site of a place called the Blue Hole, where in the 1960s, he actually spent time mining for gold. And here is where Jim actually lives at the moment. This is his house perched atop this spectacular thing called the Green River Gorge in Washington State, about an hour's south of Seattle. So, you know, Jim commands this spectacular view from his back porch with his waterfall cascading down the gorge right next to his home. Here's Jim's home. This is the site of the Absolute Motion Institute, which is Jim's organisation that publishes his books and from which he produces his theories of the universe. As Louise said earlier, Jim developed his theories in the 1960s. Jim developed the main framework of his theories in the early 1970s, first when he was working as a gold miner and later when he was working as an abalone diver out on Catalina Island. And this is the theoretical physicist at work. This is the back cover of one of Jim's very early books, taken on top of the hill overlooking Avalon Bay in Catalina. So this is at the peak of his creative powers. Like Einstein, Jim was 26 when this photo was taken, when his scientific creative juices were at their maximum flow. I think that's the best author photo that I've come across in a long time. I wish my author photo was as intriguing as that. Jim has a complete, over the past 50 years, he's developed a complete alternative theory of the universe. It includes a theory of space and time and matter and gravity. We can talk about some of the details more of his theory later on. I just want to sort of take you through a brief overview. So here's some illustrations of Jim's alternative theory of gravity. This is basically his alternative to general relativity. And Jim has, there are two major parts of his theory, an alternative to gravity, which is basically the alternative to general relativity, and then an alternative to the other major pillar of contemporary physics, which is quantum mechanics, which is our theory of matter and energy. So what I'm going to show you, this is some images from Jim's theory of matter and energy. And partly what I want to reveal to you here is that Jim not only has theories, he does extraordinary illustrations to convey his ideas pictorially as well as in his books, which are filled with diagrams and charts and equations and explanations of the theories. But the graphic sensibility here, I think, is particularly wonderful and, quite frankly, unique in my experience in the world of these outsiders. This is a diagram in part describing part of Jim's alternative view of how the universe came into being. So when I first encountered Jim was at the end of 1993, and I'll just briefly tell you the story. At the time, I was finishing my first book, which was A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion, and I happened to be buying a lot of books from one of LA's major second-hand book dealers, and I went in to collect something one day, and the bookseller said to me, "Oh, Margaret, this package arrived in the mail the other day, and I was about to throw it into the bin when I thought of you." And I never quite understand why, of all her customers, was me she singled out. And I actually never got around to asking her this question, but I want to draw your attention. I'm not sure if you can read this down the bottom, but it was these three lines at the bottom that really attracted my attention. In case you can't read them, I'll read it out to you. So this is basically an order form. That this was the announcement that Jim sent out in 1993 to a couple of hundred scientists and scientific booksellers around America, announcing the imminent publication of his book, The Other Theory of Physics. And the first few options were basically, here's a check, or, you know, put me on your mailing list. But it was the little boxes down the bottom which really drew my attention to the fact that he was an unusual individual. So his first option of the bottom ones is, "I'm very interested in this theory, but at this time I am very short of cash. However, the enclosed letter expressing my response to your ideas qualifies me to a free copy of your book on its publication date." Option number two, this one, is, "Your idea interests me. Please put me on the Absolute mailing list for a next free mailing." And option number three, which was the clincher for me, was, "Your gravity theory sucks." So this immediately signaled to me that Jim had a very rare quality among these people. The man had a sense of humour. And that is actually, I've come to realise in the 18 years since, I'm not entirely sure that I've met another outside theorist with a sense of humour. So for me, this signified that I should actually, you know, perhaps meet this chap and look into it further. And I did look into it further, and what I found was a doorway to this extraordinary alternative universe of just tremendously alive and vital, creative, speculating, and incredible scientific, really inventiveness. Basically, Jim has a theory. The core of Jim's theory is that everything in the universe is made up of these ring-shaped particles that he calls circlons. And all matter is composed of these. And what we see here is the atomic elements. So the entire atomic periodic table can be built up of these ring-shaped particles. So this is a simple atom, the helium atom, then we go up to lithium, and we go up to nitrogen. And as you see, you're adding more rings. It's sort of like subatomic chain mail. And Jim has the entire periodic table explained this way, as well as the three-dimensional versions. He has sort of schematic two-dimensional diagrams of the entire periodic table. And there's the entirety of the table. Jim began to think about his theories in the late 1960s, early 70s, and at the time he started doing this, not only did he believe that he could have his own theory of physics, but he was completely undaunted by the challenges of publishing. So he made a series of books to actually explain his ideas that were, he produced all the diagrams, printed them himself, and these were kind, this, it should be said that these books were being published at the same time that punk rock was developing. And what I think they are in many ways, just graphically and visually, is like the scientific equivalent of a punk rock zine. That same sort of, you know, vital, creative, in-your-face aesthetics. And this is being produced, basically, the book, the year this book came out is the same year that the Ramones started, and the next year the Sex Pistols would sort of unleash their DIY ethos across the globe as a sort of call to artists and designers and producers to do their own thing. And what I think is remarkable here is that Jim was taking this punk rock DIY do-it-yourself ethos and applying it to science. Now, one of the extraordinary places that these ring-shaped particles appear in nature, and Jim points out that ring-shaped particles actually appear at all levels of reality. One of the places they appear is it turns out that divers can blow ring-shaped bubbles underwater, and Jim found that out when he was being an abalone diver. It turns out dolphins can actually make ring-shaped bubbles. And this inspired Jim to think, well, these are incredibly stable forms. Is it possible that ring-shaped form, this was his inspiration, that these ring-shaped forms, which are actually incredibly stable and easy to produce, might actually be the essence of atoms? Because it has been a very deep mystery in the history of science. What is the fundamental form from which atoms and ultimately the entire periodic table is composed? Now, Jim at first thought that he might actually use these ring-shaped bubbles underwater to do experiments to test his ideas about zirklons and see if they really behaved in the way that his theory predicted they would. It's quite difficult to make them underwater. So he ultimately, when he moved, he ultimately left Catalina and moved up to Washington State, where he realised that a much better way to make these ring-shaped forms was basically using smoke rings. And I'm sure that many of you have seen smoke rings, people blowing them with cigars, but Jim decided he'd make them on a giant scale, and here he is doing it with a garbage can, and the smoke is generated through a disco fog machine. So what this is, Jim's, as Jim sees it, is basically particle physics. This is experimental particle physics that Jim can do in his backyard for about $3.50, not having to spend the tens of billions of dollars that the particle physicists have to spend building these absolutely giant particle accelerators. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating is if you look at the world's biggest particle accelerators, like the CERN accelerator in Europe, it's a big circle. So the physicists themselves are actually sending their subatomic particles around these giant circles. They're basically, the CERN accelerator can be thought of as a giant zirklon of projected desire. So here is a bunch of smoke rings going across Jim's front yard. And I want to end by actually showing you smoke rings in action. So this is... I've got more animations and things that we can show in the discussion, but I want to get to talk to Jim, so let us just go. This is smoke rings Jim's produced in his backyard. And what you notice is they have incredible structural stability, incredible integrity, which is exactly what you need to build atoms. One of the primary qualities of atoms is their incredible longevity and their incredible, the integrity of their form. So there's much more that we could say, but it would be wonderful to hear some of it in Jim's own words. So please welcome Jim to the stage. Jim, I'd like to start by asking you the question that when I first met you, I think was uppermost in my mind, is that what gives you the courage to think that you can succeed where Einstein and Stephen Hawking have failed, to have your own theory of everything?
Well, I've been working on it for so long, I don't know that it's courage. It's just something that I like to do, you know. I did a lot of it for myself. I really haven't ever tried to tell anybody else about my theories, and I'm just working to complete them, and I've fairly well completed them now, but there hasn't been any other point where I had everything together to the point where I wanted to tell anybody about it.
Except that you've been producing this series.
You know,
of
when I finished the periodic table, then I had that all finished, and I sent that out to a number of people to see what kind of a reaction I'd get. But then when I was working on the rest of my theory, I didn't really send that out until I had completed everything. So I don't know that it takes courage to do that. It takes persistence. You know, I did it for myself.
I think a lot of people, in an age where, I think one of the hallmarks of our age is that a lot of us are actually, in some sense, losing a lot of skills that people once had to do things for themselves. And I think one of the hallmarks of our time is that we are a bit used to thinking if something needs doing, we have to sort of call an expert. But you have an incredibly self-determined life. If something needs doing, you do it yourself, including build your own theory of the universe.
Yeah, well, actually, my theories are very simple. They aren't really based on any brand new ideas or anything. They're based on the very simple, basic, fundamental experiments of physics. You know, I'm actually starting at a lower level than the mainstream physics. They start with a lot of metaphysical assumptions. And I don't do that. I start with just the basic experiments and then try to interpret them in the most basic way that they can be done. And they don't do that in mainstream science. They want to make everything far more complicated than it really is at its basic level.
Now, one of the most long-term questions in the history of physics is, what is the fundamental structure of matter? What is it that atoms are made up from? And this has been a question since the pre-Socratic time, and for 2,500 years in Western culture, people have had a lot of different ideas about what atoms might be made up from. Can you tell us the story of how you came to the realization that they were made up of these ring-shaped particles?
Well, basically, I believe that matter, there's two forms of matter. There's electrons and there's protons. And everything else is made up from them. When you bring them together, you can make photons from them. Mm-hmm. And these particles are eternal, and they have existed since the beginning of time. And my theory that, my alternative theory of the Big Bang, instead of beginning as a singularity, I just begin with a proton and an electron, and I have a way that they can come together and divide and continually divide until they make all of the protons and electrons that are in the universe today.
But how did you come to the idea that the circle form was the fundamental matter?
Well,
smoke rings and underwater rings were inspiration, but I know you went through a long process of trying different forms.
Well, when I tried to construct the neutrons and protons together to make the nuclei of all the different elements, I tried a number of ways to to put them together so they would fit together mechanically. I tried, you know, spheres and circles and balls and different kinds of shapes. And then one day I saw some smoke rings, and it occurred to me that the fundamental shapes of these protons and electrons could be these hollow ring-shaped, torus-shaped particles.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as I started to fit these together and put the proton around the meson, which is another circular-shaped particle, and then you could fit the neutrons inside of them. And then there were only a certain few ways that you could put them together. And as I started putting them together and adding a proton and a meson to each one, and then putting neutrons inside to lock the particles together, I was able to create all the elements, all the 104 or 5 elements at the time, just in one evening. I just started putting, I made these little plywood rings, and I started fitting together one at a time and adding in each place where it seemed like they should go, and they just kind of created themselves. It only took one evening to create all the elements.
And this is a good moment, I think, to show the audience one of the extraordinary animations. Jim's initial process, as he said, he cut out hundreds of these little plywood rings about that big and literally physically taped them together to make these beautiful little delicate spidery models. But over the years, he's done many different versions of this, the most recent being a three-dimensional computer animation. So I thought we'd just show a minute or so of these extraordinary animations. Because one of the things that is a hallmark of Jim's career is he's not content to just say the idea might work. He wants to physically see it. He wants the material embodiment of it, because he believes that at heart, nature is a mechanical system, and therefore it has to literally make sense as a mechanical object. So let us just...
When I first started working on nuclear structure, I tried to develop, to decide a shape of a particle that could be fitted together mechanically so that the nucleus of the various elements could all be fitted together in a mechanical process. I came up with the idea of the circlon, a circular-shaped particle that's hollow in the middle, like a hollow ring. If you had a microscope which allowed you to peer down to the very nucleus and be able to see the structures at their fundamental levels, all you would see is these circlon-shaped particles. Basically, there's two particles that form.
So I'm just going to take you briefly through this. So basically, in Jim's theory,
you can see the neutron going around inside of the meson, and that red circle is the proton.
And so what this is
basically... This is a deuterium nucleus here, hydrogen.
So this is the first element of the periodic table. And then what happens is that as more circles join together, you build up the entire periodic table, as it were, like a growing subatomic mesh. And the way that they fit together naturally mirrors the pattern of the elements in the table with the particular rows and columns. Stop there. The video that you're seeing, by the way, is before I wrote my book about 10 years ago, my former husband and I, Cameron Allen, made a documentary about Jim's life and work. And I'm very glad that we captured this particular time in his life, because it was when Jim was really involved in the experimental verification of his ideas and when he was developing his ideas about smoke rings. So we managed to capture in the film a kind of seminal time in the evolution of Jim's physics. And I would like to acknowledge Elsa Longhauser, who's here somewhere. Elsa is the director of the Santa Monica Museum, and almost 10 years ago in 2002, Elsa, as a museum curator and director, recognised the beauty and the validity of this subject and invited us to curate an exhibition about Jim's work at the Santa Monica Museum. And I think, to my knowledge, it's probably, Elsa's been a great champion of outsider art in America, and to my knowledge, this is the first and only time that there has ever been an exhibition of an outsider scientist, and it was really visionary of Elsa to see the power and the value of this work as an amazing aesthetic totality. Jim, now that you have developed your theories fully, what do you hope will happen?
Well, I would like to find someone that you know, that can evaluate this stuff in terms of the standard theory. Like the standard theory of nuclear physics, they say that all these particles are held together by the strong nuclear force. And this is a force that is very short-ranged and only extends like just to the surfaces of the protons and the neutrons. And so what I'm saying is that they're held together mechanically rather than being held together by this strong force. When I put together this system, all I did, I started with a table of the experimental nuclei of about, there's 2,000 different isotopes of the elements. There's actually 282 stable isotopes, which makes all of the elements that are stable. And then in these atomic accelerators, they've bombarded these stable isotopes with neutrons and protons, and they've created almost 2,000 unstable isotopes. Well, what I did is I started fitting my neutrons into these stable isotopes and adding them and taking them away, and I can show a model for every one of these 2,000 unstable isotopes, just how they fit together. And when I get a model of a particular element that is the most balanced and fits together the best, I mean, without too many extra neutrons, it invariably turns out to be the most common isotope of that element. So my models fit perfectly with everything that's known about nuclear physics and the construction of the elements. And I have a way to show that my theory is superior to the standard theory. It deals with the way that the palladium is constructed and also gold.
So that what Jim's saying is that there is a particular point in which his theory makes predictions about certain atomic elements that could be experimented on if he's...
So if I could get someone with a nuclear accelerator to study gold, for example, I'm sure that I can show that my electron structure for the gold atom is different than their electron structure, and the difference can be shown. And it's kind of odd that I spent a lot of the early years of my life looking for gold, and then when I finally put together the nuclear structure, gold was the one element that could prove whether my model was right or wrong.
Now, you raise a very interesting issue here, Jim, because you've just said if you could get the physicists with the accelerators to do a particular experiment, it would determine whether your theory or the standard model of physics was correct. Now, that raises the issue of, in physics, as in all sciences, there are many people with ideas about things that could be done, and there are some decisions get made about which ideas are going to get tested. Now, you belong to an organisation called the Natural Philosophy of the Natural Philosophy Alliance, which is an organisation of outsider physicists. Your own term for it is dissident physicists. And there are more than 2,000 dissident physicists listed on the Natural Philosophy Alliance website. There are more than 2,000 dissident theorists, more than 1,300 books, and more than 5,000 papers. But you feel that of all of these people, you have the final theory. What makes you so confident that your theory is correct?
Well, it really works, and it's based on really very simple and fundamental experiments. I mean, I don't make a lot of assumptions. It's just ways of explaining experiments, like the nuclear structure. I mean, there isn't any way that I could fit these things together in a different way. I mean, because of the shape of the particles and the way that they can fit together, you know, I didn't ever see any other way that you could come anywhere near making all the elements with a different model. I mean, maybe there is, but... And in nuclear, the standard model, they don't say they're all fit together in a specific way. They call what they have the liquid drop model, which means that all these protons and neutrons are just in a ball, kind of moving around together, but they don't have any particular shape or form or anything. They're just stuck together in this quantum field kind of a thing, which, you know, you can kind of explain it with mathematics, but their mathematics is nothing compared to my models.
Now, this is one of the things that in many of the writings of people in the Natural Philosophy Alliance, and indeed on their own website, there's one of the common complaints that dissident physicists have is that mainstream physics has become too highly mathematically abstract, and that there is a sense in which the mathematization of physics has actually taken it out of the realm of common sense and therefore literally become nonsensical. Is that the way that
you would see it? I can see that. I mean, there's a lot of mathematics in my book, but it's mostly like algebra and explaining things like, oh, how clocks slow down when they're in a gravity field or when they're sped up, and different ways of calculating photons and Doppler shifts and all that. But it's nothing compared to these multi-dimensional mathematics that they use to explain, you know, string theory and Einstein's gravitational theory. My gravity theory and his theory are just kind of a mirror image of one another. I'm not really disputing what he says. It's just a different interpretation.
But your
And his mathematics would work for... I don't understand his mathematics that much. I mean, they're very complex, but I know because of the way that his would explain mine just as well.
But your mathematics and most people in the NPA's mathematics is relatively simple mathematics.
Yes.
It's not, you know, advanced, as you say, multidimensional group theory or, you know, Lie algebras, etc., which contemporary physics from relativity on has been based on increasingly sophisticated, very, very difficult to comprehend mathematics. And now we have string theory, which is saying that we live in a 10 or 11 dimensional universe, which is using very advanced and difficult mathematics that even most physicists would say they don't comprehend.
But these models are mathematical. This is a form of math right here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. It isn't. It's not like normal math, but it is a type of math, and it does explain the nucleus really well.
Well, it's a very nice way of putting it, Jim. You know, in my view, mathematics is the language of pattern and form. And I think a lot of mathematicians feel that way. And what this is clearly a highly developed pattern. And so any highly developed pattern has some kind of mathematics behind it. This is a highly visual form. It's a form of visual mathematics. Let me get you to comment on you do belong to this organization which has more than 2,000 dissident theorists. I assume that every one of the others probably also believes as passionately as you do that they have a true theory of the universe. What happens when you all get together?
Yeah, and nobody listens to anybody else. Everybody's got their own idea, but, you know, they don't pay too much attention to anybody else. And they're quite different than mine. Most of the people in this organization have theories about ether.
And we should say, ether theories were ideas that come from originally the 17th century and were very prominent from the 17th through 19th century, that the whole of space, the whole cosmos at the cosmological and the subatomic level was pervaded by this superfine mist-like stuff called the ether. And it was Einstein's special theory of relativity that said, hey, wait a minute, we don't need this ether stuff. Instead of ether, we can explain the phenomena that ether was supposed to explain by thinking of time and space as being relative
to one
another.
Well, yeah, they have gravitational fields, and all the different fields that they have are basically another kind of ether. I mean, they're just specialized forms of ether. Instead of having this one ether that explained everything, they have, you know, 12 different dimensions which are ether-like.
It's true, actually, contemporary physics.
Whereas all of my stuff is very mechanical. There's no fields, there's no ether. Mm. There's only really protons, electrons, and photons.
But what actually happens, like when you're at an NPA meeting and you give a paper, do the other NPA theorists, you know, are they interested in discussing your theory, or are they just waiting for their own turn?
They're
at
waiting
the podium?
For them. I mean, you know, there'll be a few questions and things like that. Kind of pointed as to, you know, why mine isn't an ether theory.
And why isn't yours an ether theory?
But there really is very little communication between them. I mean, everyone has their own theory, and they don't have any doubts about whether their theory is correct. And so everyone gets up and gives their theory, and that's it. You know, there's very little discussion. Except, the ether people go back and forth, you know, about this, my ether theory is a little different than your ether theory.
So how do you think that it can be determined in the long run who's got the true and final theory?
Well, it's relatively easy to do. You just have to be able to look at it. I mean, all these ether theories, they aren't based on experiment. They don't make predictions, you know. Whereas all my theories make it predictions. But the problem is that my predictions are the same as Einstein's. I mean, we're looking at things in kind of an opposite way. So when we're talking about how the clocks on the GPS satellites run faster than clocks on the Earth. Mm-hmm. Well, I predict just how fast those clocks are going to run, and it's the same exact value that Einstein predicts, because we're working with the same idea, but it's just backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're like the anti-Einstein.
So all of my predictions are basically already have been made by Einstein, but we're looking at things differently. So I'm not really disputing Einstein so much as to how he says the world works, or, I mean, his predictions and his mathematics and all that stuff. I'm just saying that, you know, it's happening in the opposite kind of a way.
So in a sense, Jim, it's interesting that in the history of physics, Einstein is the person in the early 20th century who said, I'm going to revolutionize science. And he introduced a radical new way of seeing. And now, a century later, you're overthrowing Einstein and saying, let's see it in a whole new way. So you want to have, as it were, a similar revolution in physics, where we essentially throw out much of the last 150 years of physics and conceive of things in a new circlon-based way.
Yeah, well, we're not really throwing out, you know, the whole physics is still there. It's just the way that it's interpreted. You know, there's nothing that's really changed. I mean, you aren't going to change the way that the world works, you know. Mm. I mean, it's just you're explaining how it works in a different way.
Yes.
Einstein explained his gravity, that it was a bending of space and time. It was something that space-time that did. And I explained gravity that it's a bending of matter and time. Mm-hmm. We both explain gravity in terms of changing geometries, but it's the different geometries, you know. Mm. It's not space but matter that's that's changing.
So Jim once said it to me, something changes. Is it matter or space? Einstein chose space. Jim believes it is matter. So I would like to open out the discussion to you all, and please comments, questions, if we could stick to not too long comments and mainly questions if possible.
In your book, you mention a nice example of Feynman working hard to understand Newton's geometric explanation for planetary orbits. I wonder if you could say a word. It seems to relate to these various explanations we see here.
Well, in the book, I tell a story about Richard Feynman, the great Caltech physicist and pioneer of quantum theory. And Feynman did a beautiful thing once, which I think relates to what Jim has done. Feynman, who was one of the great pioneers of quantum electrodynamics, which is a very, very complicated mathematical field theory about subatomic theory, he decided he wanted to reconstruct Newton, this major proof that Newton had made about gravity and how it would show, ultimately help to convince the world that gravity was correct. But when Newton did this proof, he didn't use calculus, the new mathematics that he'd been working so hard to develop. He decided if he wanted to convince his colleagues in the 17th century that gravity was correct, he needed to show his proof about it in a tried and true form of mathematics that they would all accept, which was geometry. At the time, calculus was radically new and really regarded with a lot of mathematicians as highly suspect. And so in order to convince his colleagues about gravity, Newton chose to use the mathematics of the ancient Greeks, geometry. And Feynman thought he would, as for himself as an exercise, reconstruct Newton's proof using only geometry. Basically what he wanted to do, he wrote about this, that he wanted to, as it were, build something beautiful using only the most simplest and rudimentary tools to prove to himself that, as it were, he could do it for himself with his, you know, essentially with his own hands. But he found it immensely difficult to do Newton's proof because actually it uses very arcane geometry, even though it's a very ancient and simple tool. There's lots of complexities about geometry that most physicists don't know anymore. But when he achieved it, it took him 200 pages of geometrical reasoning, and he finally achieved it. He was immensely proud of himself. And from a contemporary physics point of view, when you've got all the machinery, all the complicated machinery of calculus, you can do this thing in a single page. But Feynman, who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, was incredibly proud of himself that he'd actually, as it were, built this old jalopy using very simple tools. And he felt very proud. And I think one of the things that this sort of reveals to us is that there is something extraordinarily difficult about, as it were, creating laws of the universe and proofs about physics using simple mathematical tools. And I use this story to contextualize what Jim is doing, that even, you know, major Nobel Prize-winning physicists today sometimes themselves feel a bit alienated or distanced from this incredibly beautiful physics that they're developing. And I know a number of physicists who, along with their very highly theoretical physics, have simple little projects that, well, they're not so simple, but using very simple tools to do really fundamental things in physics, because they want to experience, in some sense, the joy of getting under the hood and doing it for themselves. And that's a metaphor that I use to try to make sense of what Jim and these other outsiders are doing. That in a sense, they want to get under the hoods of the universe and experience how it works for themselves. Sorry?
I shall try to be fast. As you know, the speed of light is different in air as in water. But last week they did a double-blind study in France, and now the speed of light has just been enhanced. And I would love you to get an Art Bell's program, Coast to Coast, and please do a program there. I know the producer, and I would love you to do a program there, because I think you'd fit right in. I don't know if you know Art Bell.
Yes, I do.
Coast to Coast.
Yes.
I know all the producers, and I would love you to get on there and do a program.
For those of you who don't know, Art Bell is a radio host who has a much-listened-to radio program where he talks about all kinds of radical anomalies that are going on around us. He's a sort of countercultural hero in certain circles.
Hi. I was wondering about the solutions for the quantum mechanics problems in this model, especially the problems that occur like the wave-particle duality or superposition, especially in a rigid structure like this. How does the solution come about? Like, what is your interpretation for it? I know there are several quantum mechanics interpretation, probably the most famous one, the Copenhagen one, but there are others as well. So I'm wondering about yours on that. What's your take on that?
Can I just explain the question for the audience? The man is asking about a fundamental issue in quantum mechanics, which really remains one of the most fundamental challenges in theoretical physics for the last 100 years, which is that there appears to be, quantum mechanics appears to be telling us, or in some sense it is telling us, that particles can, as it were, be what's called entangled, where they can literally be in multiple states at once. And how to explain this phenomena is really an enormous subject of debate in physics for the last 60 years. What does it mean that these particles seem to be literally in two different states, in two different places at the same time? And what he's asking is, what does Jim's theory have to say about this phenomena of what's called quantum entanglement?
Well, it's based on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And I must say that I don't believe that there is an uncertainty at the very fundamental level. It's just that we aren't able to measure it because of the very nature of the photons that we use to measure things. You can't make these precise measurements. And the uncertainty principle, you know, quantum mechanics is based on the point particle. And if you allow particles to have a shape and a size, then you eliminate the uncertainty. The uncertainty is just the volume of the particle. There isn't an uncertainty of a point someplace, because there isn't a point. It's a shape.
And it's an interesting point that Jim is making, because Jim has come to a solution in his theory that's actually a very similar, the framework of it is very similar to the solution that string theorists have come to. So what Jim is saying is that in standard quantum mechanics, the particle was conceived first as a point and then as a wave around a point, but still essentially the thing is in a point. Now, part of what string theory does, and you all know string theory is the contemporary best hope that physicists have for this so-called theory of everything, and we have Brian Greene's Big Nova series on TVS, PBS about string theory running at the moment. Now, string theory says also that the particle isn't a point, that it's actually a string wrap, you know, like in a little sort of circle or kind of undulating circle.
And Jim likes to point out that, in fact, his theory is a string theory too. That it actually, his toroidal particles are made up of this little string-like substance, sort of round, tightly round like a spring in this toroidal form. So Jim likes to, is proud to say that, in fact, his theory is a string theory too. And partly it is to resolve this fundamental problem with the traditional interpretations of quantum mechanics. Now, everybody's still debating string theory, so you don't know whether it's true either, but the fundamental problem has been recognised.
You mentioned gold and palladium as key elements to your theory, and I was hoping you could elaborate on that.
Well, it's a little complicated. It has to do with the electron structure and the electron shells that form in the different elements. And I show that when palladium forms, the structure happens at a lower level in the nucleus, and the last protons that are added to make palladium happen on a second level of the nucleus rather than on the outside. And it's all explained in my books, but it's a little hard to explain it here without diagrams to show you what the difference is. And the reason that gold is the same is just like palladium in that there's a whole layer of structure that goes on the top of palladium, and to get to gold, you've completed a whole structure. And palladium has a number of different stable isotopes. Right now, just off the top of my head, it's like 7 or 8 stable isotopes. And so if you're bombing these isotopes with electrons to see where the electrons go in the shell, it's going to make it kind of confusing when you have a number of stable isotopes. Well, the reason that gold will work better is because gold only has one stable isotope. Gold 179 is the atomic weight of gold. And all of the other isotopes of gold are unstable and radioactive. So if you were doing the experiment with gold, you could get pure gold. All of your gold would only be one isotope, and all of the electrons that you were bombarding it with and trying to strip the electrons off would all be the same. So it would just come out easier than it would with palladium with a number of isotopes.
I can just explain very briefly, just to clarify what Jim said. In the standard models, in the standard models of physics, we explain atomic structure by there's a nucleus in the middle with the protons and neutrons, and then electrons, which have the negative charge, form these shells, what are called shells, around the nucleus. And the pattern of the periodic table is, as Jim's diagram shows you, the electrons effectively form these kind of shells. So you can see it's radiating out from the centre. But Jim's theory, basically, just to cut things short, the way that the shells, the structure builds up, at a certain point Jim's theory predicts, as it were, something slightly different from what the standard model does. So his, as it were, explanation of the growing structure of the elements predicts something at the point of gold that's slightly different. But
this is just the nucleus here, but every one of those little circles up there is a proton, and there is an electron attached to every one of those protons in an atom that has all of its electrons. I mean, you can strip all the electrons off and just have the nucleus, but if you add enough electrons to it, then each one of those protons has an electron attached to it.
And, so, but the fundamental point here is that at some point your model predicts something slightly different than at the point of gold. So should we...
How important is validation to you for this theory, whether it's from the establishment scientific community, the science journals that are out there? Is there something that is personally important to you with regards to how the rest of the world, I guess, views your theories?
Well, I don't know that that, I mean, you know, I'd like to have someone really look at it and show me one way or another whether it was right and how it really worked. But there's really probably not any practical applications. I mean, all of this stuff is, you know, most science is all based on how things work and experimenting and you know, theory doesn't play very much part in the actual scientific technology that we have with us. I mean, it's theory plays a small part, and it's basically just experimenting how things work and making them work better and experimenting, and it's there's not much practical application to theoretical physics.
So, I mean, what you're saying, Jim, is that for you, it's not necessarily about the practical application. It's about whether your theory is accepted as this is, as it were, the underlying reality.
Well, the thing about my theory that's really important, that really means the most to me, is the living universe idea, that my interpretation of the creation of the universe and the Big Bang. Because in my theory, it works out much better than the Big Bang theory. The Big Bang is based on all kinds of metaphysical assumptions that they just add things whenever they discover something new. And my theory starts from the very basic quantum mechanical way that things work and explains the whole evolution of the universe without jumping to all of these really wild ideas of dark energy and expanding universe and singularities. And I predict exactly what the cosmic background radiation, the temperature of it should be. Just from my Zirklon models, it shows that it should be 2.7 degrees. And the universe began with this 2.7 degree flash of photons, and those photons are still here today. And it didn't start out really hot. It started out really cold, and it's been warming up ever since.
But let me get back to this man's point. So, you know, what would actually, for you, how would you like to, as it were, be validated? What would you like? And would you like to win the Nobel Prize, Jim? Let's put it bluntly.
Well, I don't know. You know, I could use the money.
Well, actually, you get along very... You financially...
Well, yeah, but, you know... I don't know. Those Nobel people, you know, they've made a lot of mistakes over the years. And they've really given the prize to the wrong people in a number of situations. And so, you know,
you want a Nobel Prize then?
Well,
would you consider yourself in poor company? Would you want to be in that company?
You know, they don't do much with theoretical people. They do stuff with actual practical discoveries and inventions, you know, like, there's not very many prizes given to any kind of theoretical work, you know.
But they gave it this year for the people who discovered dark energy.
Well, yeah, but
which is not exactly
the dark
practical.
Energy is all, that's all wrong. I mean, they'll find out that dark energy doesn't, it's not there. It has to do with the way that the universe evolved, and dark energy isn't. I mean, I could explain dark energy, but it takes too long, you know. It's in my book, though. If you want to read about dark energy, it's either one of those books that are out there in the lobby.
Yeah. Okay.
My question is simply, I didn't hear you talk too much about neutrons. How does your theory fit in with Sir James Chadwick's neutron?
Okay, a neutron is a combination of an electron and a proton. The electron is captured by the proton, and it actually fits inside. If you give it the right proper amount of energy, you can stuff it inside. And so a neutron is just a proton and electron. It's like a hydrogen atom turned inside out.
So
I don't believe it's a separate particle, and I don't believe in quarks. There's only protons and electrons, and they're the fundamental particles of the universe, and they can't be created or destroyed. I mean, you can make electron positron pairs with high energy, but you're not really creating them, because eventually the positron is going to find an electron someplace else and they're going to annihilate. So there's a constant number of protons and electrons in the universe, and they remain constant, basically, and they're the same number. There's the exact same number of protons as there is electrons in the universe.
So basically, in Hume's theory, there is a smaller number of fundamental particles than in the standard theories of physics.
Yeah, the whole particle zoo of all these different particles are really just unstable, different configurations of protons, electrons, and photons. And there are neutrinos that are stable particles, and they do play a part in neutrons, in the formation and the decay of neutrons. But they don't have much other place in the universe, and I haven't really mentioned them tonight because there's neutrinos all running around every which way, but they don't affect anybody.
So should we? We've got time for one final question.
Yes, I wanted to ask when you were referring to, when you were referring to the global positioning system satellites, you referred to a clock, and I was wondering if you meant an atomic clock or you meant an oscillator, and so how would all that relate to your theory of physics pertaining to elements?
Well, the atomic clocks. It doesn't matter. It can be an atomic clock or a mechanical clock like a wristwatch. But when you take a clock on the surface of the Earth and you accelerate it up to where the GPS satellites are, it actually runs at a faster rate than it does on the Earth. And so they have to calibrate these clocks to run slower before they're sent up into space, so they'll run at the same rate as clocks on the Earth, so they can make the GPS system work. And the reason for this is that when you accelerate anything to a high velocity, it changes its mass. Its mass increases. And when you increase the mass of a clock, you increase the mass of its balance wheel, and it makes it slow down. And so the reason the GPS clocks run faster, it has to do with gravity. There's a lot less gravitational velocity in the upper orbit as there is on the Earth, and so the clocks actually are reduced in mass on the GPS satellites, and it makes them run a little faster. It's all laid out in my books in mathematics, but it's maybe a little difficult to explain, because when you're dealing with satellites, you have two different effects. You have the gravitational effect, and you have the effect of velocity, and they're at cross purposes with one another.
So the moral of the story here is, if you want a complete answer, buy the book. Could we, and I should say, you could buy Jim's book. Could I just end by asking a question that I'm really intrigued by? It's very clear that the audience here, many people in this audience, are really quite technically inclined and really yourselves know quite a bit about physics. Can I ask, are there any other people in this room who have theories of physics, their own theories? No. Sorry? No, I'm just intrigued because it's a surprising number of people do. So I think, Louis, do we have time to hear from this gentleman? Do you have a theory of physics?
It's more like a question.
Yes.
I've seen on YouTube how you can make generators with the rare earth magnets.
Oh, we need a microphone, please.
Oh. Well, Louise, do we have time for... No. What the gentleman is raising is that if you go on YouTube, there are a huge number of videos showing basically ideas that a lot of people have. People have many ideas that are demonstrate on YouTube about alternative theories of physics, specifically alternative ideas about energy. And you can actually, you know, if you go online, there are now many animations, many experiments purporting to show anomalous, radical new physics. And how, I think your question is going to be something like, how do we look at these theories and interpret them? How do we know if any of these people have got, as it were, a credible idea? And really, in many ways, that is the point of why I wrote this book. There are now so many people having so many different theories. How do we as a society at this point in time, when anyone can have a theory of physics and post it online or post their experiments of it on YouTube, how do we as a society, as it were, adjudicate whose theories to pay attention to, whose to even begin to take seriously, whose to put the resources into testing? And that's really the question that my book ends with. That's why I think this is an important topic, that so many people are now having their own theories of science and posting them on YouTube or posting them online or publishing their own books on Lulu. How can we as a society begin to adjudicate what we're going to do here? And I don't think that there's a clear-cut answer to that. I think we're at a unique moment in history on this question, and that's why I think this is a subject that our society needs to start to actually ask. And I think probably we need to...
That's a great place to stop. I want to thank Margaret and Jim for explaining this to us and keeping alive the spirit of inquiry. And thank you so much, and we'll join you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.